stop? Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
Well, it's Saturday night. This is the Saturday night edition of the State Sovereignty Show, brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Missouri Grassroots Radio. As always, on Saturday night, I'm Dave. That guy over there is Mike Slack. How you doing, Mike?
Doing well. Doing well.
Well, okay, we're going to roll right on into it tonight. We're not going to spend any time on chit-chat. We've got some very important and very influential people here with us, and we're going to talk about a very important subject. Tonight with us is going to be Laura Houseladen. Listeners will remember her from a while back when we talked about sound money. Her and Lloyd Sloan were with us that night. And Mike, see if that's Philip on the other line, on the empty line, will you?
And we'll do that.
We've got Frida Keogh. You listeners remember, yeah, Keogh. Yeah. You listeners will remember talking with her once about MOP, Missouri Precinct Project. And so we've got a new someone that you're not familiar with joining us tonight, the author of a white paper called Technical Reasons to Question St. Louis County Voting Results. This gentleman is Philip Michaels. These three together have been instrumental in forming a group called Coalition for Secure and Transparent Elections. If you've been following any of these three on the social media or anywhere on the internet for a while, you know that they're getting big to bringing back paper ballots and getting rid of voting machines for not only for other fraudulent reasons, but specifically because there are many technical reasons to question the validity of election results that come from these machines. We're going to roll right into it. Laura, how are you tonight?
I'm great.
I can interrupt. Laura, our third expert, is also on the line, if you could do an introduction.
Thanks for...
Philip?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think... we had an introduction. I first met Philip, I guess, in about 2006, and that was when I was living in St. Louis, and we were at an election board of elections meeting protesting the purchase of the machines. And so Philip has been involved in this, and he has very closely, as one of the founding members of the Missourians for Honest Elections, he and Cynthia Richards have faithfully observed the tech logs of the elections for the last 6 or 7 years, and seen difficulties with the paper jams, et cetera, and other technical difficulties. So they've been very instrumental in knowing the facts and getting the details on the machines.
Okay, and Frida, how are you tonight? And thanks for being with us.
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Philip, I'm Dave. You've talked with Mike already. You know Laura and Frida. How are you tonight, and thank you for being with us?
Fine, Dave. Glad to be here.
All right.
Looking forward to a nice discussion.
That was a little greeting and a sound check for anyone who doesn't know why we do that in radio and internet blog talk. So everybody's here. Everybody's sound is fine. We're going to get started right away. Philip, you start, please, by giving us a brief rundown of this white paper that I've read with great interest.
Well, what we were trying to do with the white paper was to outline for the various parties who have an interest in the outcome of the elections, that is, the people who are running for offices, what the weaknesses are in the current election process, so that they might be able to challenge the way the votes are counted, where it is not a very transparent process. And it was very, it's a pretty long paper. I won't try to go into all the pieces of it, but basically we were laying out the places where the machines gave a problem, where there are processes in the election, in the way that elections are handled that are not open for transparency, so that they can see that and before they get into it. A lot of times people who run for office and then they have a close election and they get to the other side of it and they say, well, I wish I knew how untransparent this thing was before we got into the process of doing a recount. And we were trying to give them a heads up with this white paper.
Okay. Now, briefly, if we could just review, I read this paper with interest, read through it a couple of times because it's fairly technical and I'm not a bright guy, but I was given to understand, among other things, that a person with no more than a palm pilot in their hand and a very little bit of knowledge could actually go in and tamper with a voting machine to change the outcome of an election. Am I right?
That's correct. It's really actually a little worse than that. And by the way, this information is not something that we came up with. This was a very professional group from the University of Pennsylvania and from the University of Pittsburgh and from a computing consulting group that did an analysis for the Secretary of State of Ohio of the machines looking for what the weaknesses might be. And what they found with the equipment that's used in St. Louis, in St. Louis County, that is that a single individual with they'd have to have programming knowledge, but an individual with programming knowledge would only need a palm pilot, a magnet, and access to one of these machines to take over not the vote counting on that machine, but the vote counting for the entire county of St. Louis County. And the way that works, in brief, is that the machines that are used in voting in St. Louis County have an access that faces the voter, so it's relatively private. So you can get into that machine without an election judge watching you, so to speak. And even if you don't do it during the voting time, the machines are taken to the polling places, you know, anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of weeks before the election, so the church or school may not be as closely guarded as a warehouse where these machines are normally kept. So you can get into the machine relatively easily. The software itself is not very sturdy in terms of being able to defend against access. To get in, you only need a one-digit code. And you can imagine in this day and time how difficult it would be to check 36 alternatives for what that code might be to get in. And once you get in, you bypass all of the passwords that are put in place by the local officials. And once you get in, you can then upload a virus that, because of the holes in the way the software works, can be automatically passed back to the central tabulator, and there your virus could change the results of the election without anybody knowing. And it would be very difficult for anyone to find that because the software would erase itself and you'd be left with a bunch of results you don't understand.
So basically, a voter with a limited knowledge of programming could walk into the voting booth because the machine is accessible from the front end, from the very front of the machine, close the curtain around them in the voting booth, and do whatever they wanted to do to these machines.
Well, there's no curtain in St. Louis County. And I would say it would to have a piece of software that would do what I've just described. It's not a person with limited programming language, a programming knowledge. It would be somebody
okay.
with real knowledge.
Okay.
But you don't have to have $1 million to take over an election in St. Louis County.
Right.
And if you did that in seven counties, the seven most populous counties in Missouri, you could probably take over a statewide election. And you, again, you wouldn't need any money, and you don't have to take the risk of doing it during election day because the machines are delivered to the polling places before voting day. And you can go in and make the changes on the machine, and nobody knows. You've been in the church, so what?
Yeah. Or the school or the fire station or wherever it is.
Right.
Well, now, was this report available to the people of St. Louis County before they settled on this machine?
No, it was not.
Okay.
It's called the Everest Report. You can find it online. But since it was found, I mean, the interesting thing about Missouri, and particularly about St. Louis County, is that because of the fact that the state did not have enough money to buy enough machines to handle a presidential election, they had to buy scanners so that they could use paper ballots in the presidential election, because they didn't have enough machines, didn't have enough money to buy these DREs in the election. So for the general election. So every polling place has a scanner with paper ballot that you can use to put paper ballots in. So once this report came out about the problems with the DREs, they could have simply dropped the use of the DREs and turned around and used the scanners instead, and it would have cost relatively nothing. It would mean they would be abandoning these machines, but they're not transparent. So there would be a lot of positive things that would come out of doing that. And it doesn't slow down the elections or cost anymore. You know, there are a lot of things that make this a very sound choice. But nobody's done anything, so.
Okay. Now, let me turn to Laura here for a moment. Laura, you are running point with the Missouri legislature on paper ballot legislation, aren't you?
Well, all three of us, plus Cynthia Richards, were lobbying, you know, very diligently this last session. So we're all pretty aware of how that went down. So,
we are. Well, we may not all be aware. Give us a brief summary.
Okay, and Frieda, feel free to jump in and fill up
yes,
any
Frieda.
Time. So, what? We had legislation this year as well as last year, and that the four of us were working. Before that, Cynthia Richards and Philip Michaels had virtually the same legislation that they were working as Democrats, and then Frieda and I joined as Republicans. And we got our legislation sponsored in the Senate by Brian Nieves, and in the House by Sue Entlicker, who is chairman of the Elections Committee. And we passed the legislation through the Senate. It was heard in Chairman Wasson's committee, our Senator Wasson's committee on elections and financial services, or whatever I forget the whole title of the committee. And it passed out of committee. We had witness forms that Ron Calzone from Missouri First helped us get to the public, and we had, I think, around 400 of those come in for the Senate hearing. Might have been a few less. And we, the only opposition at that point was the Secretary of State. And help me, Frieda. What was their opposition? Do you remember?
That it would cost too much money to replace the paper ballot.
Right.
They attacked the Cisco Nodal Pavilion because they claimed that it required the purchase of new machines, when that was absolutely false. Our bill did not require the purchase of new machines.
Our
right,
bill was simply to... Go ahead.
Because the scanners, Phillips told us the scanners are already in place, so all they do is fall back to the machines that they already have. Am I right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So
the only opposition in the Senate committee, Republican opposition, was Senator Eric Schmidt from St. Louis County.
Are you talking about in the final vote? Because he no, wasn't
in
on
the... In the hearing.
Okay.
In the elections committee in the Senate. No?
Okay. I didn't remember him being on the committee. So, but I...
Maybe I'm wrong. I'm sorry.
any rate, it did pass through committee and was taken relatively speedily to the floor for a vote, and it passed 22-11 in the Senate sometime in near the end of March, I believe.
Yeah,
and,
it was before spring break.
Okay, right before spring break, was it? Or right, any rate, that can be looked up online. And then it was, of course, would go over to the House. In the meantime, we had been working with Sue Entlicker, who's a representative from the southwest part of the state, from Polk County, I believe. And as I said, she was chair of the election committee. And we wanted it to move quickly through that committee and had been led to believe that it would be something that she would work to get through the committee. But we were running into resistance, it seemed like. And at one point, I talked to her after a election committee meeting, your hearing, that she had just face-to-face, just she and I, and she told me that she was being told not to let it out of committee and not to take a vote on it. She said that it was not leadership that was doing that. But nonetheless, it was clear to us that it was not going to be getting out of her committee. And since the Senate bill had just passed the Senate and was slated to go into her committee, we were quite concerned because we thought then our bill would be dead, our Senate bill would be dead. So we worked through Tim, excuse me, we worked through Tim Jones' office to get it into Paul Kirtman's committee because he said that he would take it and get it out right away. And at this point, we were into, I think, April by then. So it was important to act on that. So Paul got it into his committee. We worked to explain it to his committee, and he passed it out the next week. You want to add anything,
House,
Frida?
House.
Or Phil? Yes.
No.
He passed it out of the House.
Downsizing
Government Committee.
So now the Senate bill, duly passed in the Senate, is out of the House committee and headed for the House floor. Where do we go from there, Laura?
Well,
we go to the rules.
Well, it had to go through the Rules Committee, and then it had to go to the Financial Review Committee. We got it through Rules Committee relatively easily. Jeannie Riddle passed it out of Rules with the help of Tim Jones. And then it had to go to Financial Review Committee, and because our bill had a fiscal note of $20 million, which was a bogus note by the Secretary of State on the purchase of new machines, the Fiscal Review Committee refused to hear our bill on the order of Mr. Deal, the floor leader.
Well, here,
Mr. Deal did not want this bill to come to the floor. And it was even in violation of the House rules. The House rules say the House handler has the right to ask for the review of the bill. McGaugh, who had taken up the bill after Kirkman's committee, was not allowed to bring the bill up for review in fiscal review. So it died.
Yes, that was Flanagan, Representative Flanagan, the chairman of the Rules Committee, who broke the rule. The chairman of the Fiscal Review Committee, who broke the rules by not letting Joe Don McGaugh get a vote on that. The rules say that Joe Don McGaugh should have gotten a vote on that. Now, that was a rule we didn't know at the time, and this was next to the last day of the session. So we actually read about that rule. Frieda found that rule, like, the next day. And by then it was virtually the last day of the session. Yeah.
Right.
But we know for a fact that Mr. Deal stopped our bill from coming to the floor. And let me tell you something. Laura and I were in his office pleading with him to let our bill come to the floor because many people across the state wanted this bill passed. And he said to both of us, I do not care what the people want. I do not want this bill on the floor.
Did he say why?
He doesn't like it. He likes electronic machines. He thinks there could be more fraud with paper ballots. And I agree that you could do fraud with paper ballots. And when I responded to him that the way to stop voter fraud on paper ballots is by having better educated poll workers, he got very irate. And then he told us, I don't care what the people want.
He said that it's intuitive that electronic machines are more secure than paper. And when we offered several times to give him information from experts, you know, these IT professionals, these professors at Stanford and MIT, et cetera, he would have none of it. He was not interested. He pointed to the book on his desk called The Big Tent and said, there's probably an expert in here, and they're on my side, and all it takes is one person on my side to discount all your experts. We've never been in an office where we were treated like we were in that meeting. Right, Frieda?
I'm still steaming about that. But he told us he didn't care what the people wanted.
Okay, more about Representative Deal later in the show. We are going to circle back around to that. I want to jump back to Philip for a minute. Philip, are we talking specifically in this white paper and with the technicalities that you've talked about a specific machine?
Yes, we were designing that paper for people who run for office in St. Louis County.
Okay.
So we were very specific about this machine and the weaknesses of this machine. Fortunately, that Everest report describes the weaknesses of most of the machines currently in use in the Missouri. So for another county, it would have been different.
Yeah, that was my follow-up question, that this kind of machine, the machine that doesn't require a paper ballot with a scanner, is in use. I know down here in Greene County, we still use paper ballots and scanners. So they're not paper ballots like the listeners like you remember, where you go through and you mark an X by the name, and then someone goes through by hand, and you know, they're there till 5 o'clock in the morning counting votes. But they are paper ballots. It is an archived copy of what you voted for any future need, and it's read then by a scanner. That's how we do it here. But how much of Missouri, Philip, is wrapped up in this electronic-type voting?
Well, the big users are the urban places. Most of the rural counties, more rural counties, are still using paper ballots with scanners.
Right.
We actually did a count of the number of votes captured on DREs by 50 counties, by all the counties in the state back in 2006. And of those counties that we looked at, 50 of them had captured a total of 1,000 votes on 1,000 machines. That's one vote per machine. So most of the rural counties don't use them at all, and St. Louis County is the biggest user, without any question.
Okay. Now, when I go in down here in Greene County, and we've got the one where you know, there's the back end of an arrow, and then there's the front end of an arrow, and then you make some kind of a line between the tail of the arrow and the head of the arrow. But there are others. There are little, you know, little color in the circle ones, and you know, several other different kinds that are then read by a scanner. Was I right in saying then that that the paper that I actually filled out is a permanent archive of the votes in that precinct?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And that's what we lack in St. Louis County.
Now,
go ahead.
Now, when I put this piece of paper in the machine, is there a way for me to know that the machine has counted what I intended it to count?
You can only know that it counted this particular ballot, that it read the ballot. That's all it tells
right.
you.
Okay.
It doesn't tell you who you voted for or anything like that. So
right.
you can know it was counted, but that's it.
Now, what is the thing with these tapes that these DREs in St. Louis County are supposed to be kicking out that tell me, you know, that I can use as a receipt for my vote? What kind of information is on this tape?
Well, it's not actually a receipt, okay? It's a record, supposedly a record of how you voted. And it's like
okay.
a cash register tape. It runs under a transparent plastic lid down in the lower right-hand corner of the machine. And if you have a long ballot, you have to be careful that every time you mark something, like we had 36 items on a ballot not too long ago, every time you mark something, you have to go down and look at the tape and make sure it produces a record that exactly matches how you voted.
Okay.
Our research suggests that 9 times out of 10, people do not look at this tape. It's called a verifiable paper tape, and it's supposed to be a permanent paper record of the vote. But since nobody's looking at it, if I'm going to set up a program that changes my vote from A to B, I can record anything I want on that tape because nobody's looking at it. And when you get done, the tape, what's in the tape and what's in the memory of the machine and what's in the total at the county level are all going to be the same because I recorded the wrong vote and you don't know it because you didn't look down at the tape when it was being typed up.
Okay, so I go in and let now for us folks out here like me who've never seen or had any contact with one of these machines, I just want to go through this again. I go into the voting booth or the voting seat or the voting chair or whatever they use there, and there's a machine in front of me, and on that machine I choose candidate B. At the same time, then, a tape slides by under a plexiglass or something where I could, if I wanted to, look down and say, oh, okay, so it got my vote for B. And then I go down to the next question, and I vote for candidate A, and I look down at the tape, and I say, okay, it got right that I voted for candidate A. Is that about right?
That's correct.
But this isn't a tape I take with me. This tape stays with the machine and is theoretically then the permanent copy of votes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Theoretically,
okay. Now,
they jam a lot. So
right.
When
now,
they jam, if they're jammed for a couple of hours, which does happen, again, recall, nobody is looking at the tape. So when they jam,
right.
nobody notices.
And this becomes a problem. And we're going to get into this in a moment, but just to foreshadow a bit, this becomes a problem if we talk about a recount with this jam tape, right? It's gone.
That's correct.
It's gone. What got voted on in that machine is gone forever.
Well, the thing is that there, and I'm sure that the county directors of elections would tell you this, that there are multiple records of the vote.
Oh, okay.
But the records that exist are all electronic, and they were all created by the software in the machine.
Exactly.
Now, you can't know what that software does, and your only chance for catching an error, and it doesn't have to be a malicious error. It can be, and there have been, a number of just normal, you know, human stupidities that happen that cause the voting to be captured incorrectly. But your only chance to catch that is that printed tape at the bottom, and if it jams and it's unusable, then their only record is electronic, and you have no chance to catch any error in the programming, period, because you have to trust whatever's in the machine to be correct.
Right.
Anyway.
So isn't it possible, Philip, that I vote and it tells me correctly on the tape who I said I voted for, but the machine itself, because it's been programmed maliciously or erroneously, the machine itself is actually recording something else?
Yes. Yeah, all of that's possible. Just like any computer program, you can do all kinds of things.
Sure.
The question is how much risk you want to take. And if I were writing a program, I would want all the records to be the same, and even the ones that I've changed, so to speak. And if I change them from A to B, I want it not possible for anybody to prove that anything happened. And so if you print it on the tape, in my little polling place, If in a hypothetical situation, if you want to change 5% of the votes from one candidate to another in a race, and that will switch many races in this environment, 5% of the records are being changed by some malicious program, then they're only going to be about three people who come to the judge and say, because they looked at the tape. You know, remember, one in ten is looking at the tape. So only about three people are going to come to the judge and say, well, something's wrong, the computer didn't record it right, or I must have hit the wrong, you know, person or something because it's got the wrong name on here. That's not enough to cause the judges to be upset about things and to call for some kind of investigation.
Frieda,
yes.
What happens when I go to an election judge and say to a poll worker and say, this machine isn't recording my vote right? I'm just one guy. I go up to my precinct captain and I say, or my precinct worker, and I say, this thing didn't record my vote right. What happens?
It's possible that the poll worker will say, well, you're too strong. That's not possible. But it's also possible that the poll worker will say, well, if you did not push the finish button yet, the poll worker can reverse your vote, can cancel out your vote, and you start all over again.
Okay.
But you have to catch it before you finish it. If you hit the finish button, it's gone.
What does the poll worker do, Frieda, or what would you educate when you educate poll workers? What do you educate them to do when the fifth person in the morning walks up and says that?
She would tell the supervisor to shut the machine down, to call the technical roving deputy and make sure that the machine is calibrated correctly and to make sure it works correctly.
Okay.
A lot of poll workers, in my opinion, don't do that. They take the position that the voter might not know what they're talking about.
Even five in a 3-hour period?
It's possible. It's very difficult to say, but poll workers in general assume that the machines are running correctly.
Okay.
They are reluctant to take the word of a voter.
Oh, yeah, voters can't be trusted. We know that. Philip,
yes.
what is what is the software in the scanners that we use down here in Greene County that scan the paper ballot? What is it about that's so much more either simplistic or technically sophisticated than the other machines that I couldn't do the same thing to a scanner, make it count 5% of the votes wrong?
Well, you could do that. I mean, it really is, you're talking about the same process. But the machines are, there are fewer, in St. Louis County, there are a lot fewer scanners. There's only one per polling place, so there's not as much opportunity for that. But secondly, and most importantly, is that you can get caught. If you are doing it on a scanner, you can get caught. Because why?
Oh, because there's a paper ballot.
Exactly. So if there's a random audit, in other words, and many people who are working in various boards of elections don't know what random means, but if you actually have a random audit, you can come back and count the paper ballot votes versus what the machine recorded. And you can find either an error or a malicious change of some sort. You can discover that, but you can't do that with a DRE. It's not possible.
Because the machine is the final authority.
Everything, every part of every record that you have that comes out of the DRE was controlled by the machine. So, and the first thing you have to do if you're going to audit a DRE is to say, I assume that all the software worked correctly. And I'm going to tell you, having been in a Fortune 500 company at one time, that the auditors in the Fortune 500 company would throw you out if they thought that they had to make that kind of assumption. And you have to make that assumption every time you count votes using the DREs.
Okay.
There's nobody checking the software.
Okay. So we're going to move on. We're going to move on into recounts. When there is a need for a recount, and in Missouri, it's any time I believe that a recount is likely or almost certain. Any time that a election is within 0.5%, am I right on that? One of you?
I think it's
1%. 1%. So we're going to have a recount, and we've got one of these machines where the tape jammed for 5 or 6 hours. What do we do there? What do we do to recount those votes if there's no record?
They print new tape from the electronic vote in the machine.
That's what they're doing right now in St. Louis County, and Frieda has been observing the election recount.
Okay.
So she asked specifically about that.
So, Frieda, tell me what they do now. Explain that to me in terms that even someone as silly as me can understand.
I went to the Board of Election yesterday as an observer of the recount of Amendment 1.
Right.
That was the Farm Bill. On Thursday, they had recounted all the paper ballots, physically reviewed each paper ballot, and they showed me some of the results where somebody had voted correctly on the candidates, but then when it got to the amendment, they said on the margins, they said yes or no, which the machine did not count because it could not read that. It was considered an undervote. But in a recount, they have to look at all of the notations by the voter on the ballot, and they could tell that this voter had intended to vote no on Amendment 1, so it now becomes a no vote.
Are you telling me that I could have actually put a circle in the yes area and they're going to read some scratching on the side of the ballot and change my vote?
Yes. They look for intent of the voter.
Oh, my. That's dangerous. That's as dangerous as a machine.
Yeah, you remember the hanging chad? That's what that is. They have to look at intent of the voter. Anyway, so they find new votes. based on what the person had intended to vote on the paper ballot.
All right.
Now, yesterday they said they had to recount, I like the term, they had to recount all the paper rolls from the electronic machines because the Secretary of State had ordered them to look at all the rolls, the paper rolls. And I asked the question, what happens with the machines where the paper jammed? You don't have a paper roll. They said we had to print all the paper rolls on machines that had jammed, and the paper rolls are printed from what is in the machine, the electronic vote in the machine. That's what they recount.
Okay. So, basically, we get back to this thing that Philip talked about before, where whatever the machine said I did is in fact what I did, whether it's in fact what I did or not.
Correct.
Okay. That's almost as dangerous as someone taking a guess by looking at some hen scratchings on my ballot as to what I intended, in my mind. But
the thing is, David, in terms of fraud, what has happened with the use of computers is what computers have done everywhere. It makes things easier. So electronic election fraud can be accomplished by a single person for the whole state. That's not possible on paper.
Right. No, I'm following what you're saying. And I was just making some unsolicited side comments about my horror when I heard Frieda say that they actually go in there and make some vote changes based on something someone wrote on the side of the ballot in the margin or something. But,
I'd like to make a comment at this point, if I might. It's maybe a little off the subject, but there are a lot of opportunities for people to fudge things in elections. And in general, I think we're way too trusting. And there should be more oversight than there is. And I can talk about specific things that I've seen just in my Crawford County experience here. And we're a small county where, you know, we probably all do the right thing and trust each other to do the right thing. But there are opportunities either for malicious or personal errors. And because of the way things are done, nobody would know it. I think we all have ideas on how to improve things, but I just wanted to put that in there.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to have to each probably recruit people to care more about this issue. I mean, our votes should be as important to us as our money, if not more important. And they should be treated as carefully as we would treat our money. And I saw in my county, the votes were just kept in tubs, and the random count that had to be done of the recount, the audit, it wasn't really random because they preferred to do the county that, or the precinct that was the smallest, not the precinct that was the biggest, because there's precincts, some of them are 10 times as large as others in my county. So they didn't want to recount the ones with a lot of votes. So I think pretty much every time it was always the same precinct that was recounted.
If I might add, when I say that on the paper ballots that people write in the margins, I mean they write next to what they should have marked, the little bubble they wrote right next to it. I guess you couldn't, that's not really the margins. It's clearly you can see what they intended to do, but they just didn't mark it correctly. I just wanted to clarify that. Plus, I have been a roving deputy in about 15 elections, And the more I do this, the more I realize voters need to be better educated as well as poll workers need to be better educated. We need a much more, a much better group of people that work the polls. Mostly it's retired people. They simply don't have the wherewithal to handle all these things anymore. It's very clear to me that we have to have We have to do much more education on this issue.
Okay. I'll tell you what, listeners, we're going to take a break. It's 347-677-1835, 347-677-1835. I want you to imagine while we're on break, I want you to listen to what's going on the break, but while we're on break, I want you to think about this. I make pharmaceuticals. And before I can market or sell a pharmaceutical, I have to have that pharmaceutical tested by a third party, a test that passes for integrity. What if, when I market that pharmaceutical, all of the tests were performed by testing companies that were hired by me?
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Okay, we're back. We're back. I was describing for you before we left for the break a situation where maybe it's not someone walking into the booth with a Palm Pilot. Maybe it's not someone at the County Election Commission who is tampering with machines or forcing tapes to jam or. Perverting recounts. Maybe it's just a bad machine. Maybe it's just a batch of bad machines. But Philip, aren't these machines tested for integrity before they're sent to the field?
Yes, they do something that's called a logic and accuracy test. That's done before each election. I don't know whether they physically perform that test on every single one of the 1,850 DREs in St. Louis County or not, but that test is designed to show that the machine is functioning properly. Unfortunately, if a hacker places a virus on the machine, then the hacker would know that this logic and accuracy test is coming and would be able to avoid it. So it does not protect you from hacking, but it could protect you from a machine that simply is electronically not functioning properly. There is a situation where machines are daisy chained together, that there's a potential for the machine not to function properly if the batteries are not fully charged or not charged up to the right level. I don't know the exact relationship between that and storing the votes, but there seems to be a relationship between proper battery function and the machine's functioning properly. And the reason I say that is because in reviewing the notes of the technicians after the elections, we see that the technicians during election day, a very busy day for them, they spend a lot of time checking the battery levels on these machines. The machines are all daisy chained to an outlet, so they probably don't need the battery power during most of our elections, but there's a lot of time spent on checking that and suggesting that because of the way the machine's designed, a weak battery could cause it to have erroneous results of some sort.
Okay, but I read in the paper, in the white paper that you wrote, about a quality control testing that goes into these machines, I mean at their very inception, to make sure that they are in fact doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, you know, much like the testing that would go into a pharmaceutical that we are going to allow to go out on the market, or the testing that would go into a GMO before we're going to allow people to eat it. What's the problem with this testing sequence?
Well, to begin with, the testing was this was done back before the machines were put on the market. They tested the machine in general, and the testing process was, shall we say, flawed. During the early testing of these machines, it came out that some of the testers were simply sending a report back to the people that were asking for their machines to be tested, saying that it passed, without having done anything. I'm not certain that any machine was that passed the test in this manner was subsequently retested. However, in any case, if a machine that was built in 2004, let's say, after this testing process that was not very good, there's nothing to say that the machine contained the software that was tested at that point in time. And further, you've got the problem of the software being on 1,850 machines in St. Louis County. So if I try to put an upgrade on that and I load a CD in and I put the software on there, how do I know that this is the software that was provided by the manufacturer? Or how do I know it functions correctly? There's no way to know that. There's no way to test for certain that all 1,850 machines has the right software, and all I have to get to if I were a hacker, would be to one machine, because that one machine with the right virus could then send its virus back to the central tabulator without any further involvement of me. So this process of trying to have a machine that's been tested, okay, it wasn't tested to begin with. Nobody has actually looked at the software that has been being used in the machines in St. Louis County, or in the state of Missouri, for that matter.
A million lines of code.
Well, there are probably 150,000 lines of code for each of the various types of machines. And
right.
There are multiple machines in each. So there's a PEB and there's a DRE, several machines for each polling place. So 150,000 minimum, and probably more like a million in total. So nobody is looking at that. I can tell you that I know that that would take a team of programmers 6 months to go through easily, and then you wouldn't be certain when you got to the other side that you didn't miss something that was put
right
into it. It's just too easy to overlook.
Even if a computer programmer read every one of those lines of code and said, okay, that line is is logistically sound. It fits. Anybody who has a friend who has a friend who's tried to sign up for Obamacare can tell you that even then there are going to be bugs when the button is actually pushed for the first time.
Yes, when you write code, there are a lot of things that people write that have something called a go-to in it. So
right.
you read down five lines and you hit a go-to, and the go-to sends you to 1,800 lines below. And you read another five lines, and it comes to another go-to, and this one sends you back up 400 lines. And you do this about eight times, and the programmer who's reading it may or may not know what the hell is going on at that point.
Yeah. Exactly. So, Frieda, you were trying to cut in there?
No, I wasn't. I was just listening.
Laura, were you trying to say something? Someone tried to say something.
I was saying that I think Philip was involved when the machines were originally certified in Missouri. And weren't you privy to a conversation or something, Philip, where you found that a programmer had only 2 days to look at a million lines of code, and there was just one of them, and he was the one that was... How did that work? Can you explain that?
Yeah, it was rather funny. You know, when we first started this, we went and talked to a number of people, and they would say, we would say we had this problem with it, with the machines, and they would give us an answer. And one of the answers we got was, well, we've had the code looked at. And so we accepted that. I mean, we were just citizen lobbyists, so we went back to, and we found out who the people were that were on the citizen group that reviewed the machines and said they were acceptable. And we found out that there was really only one person who was competent to look at the computer programming. And I went and talked to this person, a professor over at WashU, and I asked him, I said, well, you know, I've been told that you reviewed the software code and before these machines were accepted, and he laughed. He just laughed. And he said, yes, I did look at them to make sure that they didn't have the sonnets of Shakespeare on there instead of the code. And I looked at them to make sure that there was a specific piece of encryption software on it. But I did not have time, nor would I have been able to look at 150,000 lines of code for each one of these machines. I only was there for 2 days.
Right. And for you folks who aren't computer programmers or familiar with computer programming, when Philip says looked at code, he's not talking about picking up a James Patterson novel and reading the first chapter and following it with the second chapter and following it with the third chapter. He's talking about actually what he was talking about earlier. When you read a computer code, you read five lines and it tells you to go do something 1,800 lines later. So you go, you find that line, you make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to do before it gives the program back up to line 10 where you started. And if it does this, then it's supposed to do that, requires you to jump around three or four times. So, you know, reading 1,500 lines, 150,000 lines of computer code isn't like reading 150,000 lines of James Patterson, is it, Philip?
No, it's certainly not.
It's a tedious process. So when he says you can't read 150,000 lines in 2 days, he's not kidding. Yes, you can read a James Patterson novel in 2 days, but you cannot read and review 150,000. I mean, it is humanly impossible, isn't it?
That's correct. That's exactly right.
So we're going to jump back to Laura and Frieda for a minute. Where are we going to go from here? Brian is gone. Is Sue still there and willing to tackle this in the house?
Well, I don't think we'll be using Sue to tackle it in the house.
She pissed off at us?
Well, she did not, as I said, she was succumbing to pressure leadership. So, or at least that's our understanding of it. So we need somebody with backbone, to carry it in the House. So.
Okay. Do you have some candidates in mind, or are you putting out the call now for someone who will do this for you?
We haven't so much. We have been, we are planning to, have it carried again, but right now we are working on getting some donations together for a lawsuit that has been planned by the Missourians for Honest Elections and
specifically in St. Louis County.
Right.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
That would be a St. Louis County lawsuit and against.
Tell me, what is the difference between a group called Missourians for Honest Elections and a group called Coalition for Secure and Transparent Elections?
Well, Missourians for Honest Elections is an older group, and Cynthia Richards is the president. And Philip Michaels is the vice president. Am I right, Philip?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, and the Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections is made up of Missourians for Honest Elections and Missouri Precinct Project and it, some other groups have said they're part of it. It's kind of an umbrella group that covers, to bring different groups together who are interested in this issue.
Okay. So so you're planning on carrying this again into the Senate and the House. You don't have handlers in either chamber yet. So pre-filing is probably out of the question on this.
No, we could actually
Well, I mean, you're getting a little late. It's we're going into October
Pre-filing is December, and we have the legislation already written.
Oh, that's right. So. That's right. Yeah, you have. So yeah, you have the. I forgot you have the legislation already in hand. So, so yeah, no, you're good to go. All right. Then how do we out here, how do we keep abreast of the stat? I mean, I know I go to your page all the time, and I you come to Missouri Grassroots Coalition, and you post all the time. How does the average listener who, comes home from work at night and gets through his supper and sits down behind his computer for the first time at 8 o'clock at night, where should he be watching to keep up with what's going on this thing?
Oh, that's a fair question, a good one. I would say we should be probably more conscientious to put things on our Facebook page for Coalition for Transparent Secure Elections. I think we were pretty good during session. Since then, not so much probably.
One of the things that I would have been after was that there is even a Facebook page for Coalition for Secure and Transparent Elections. So, listeners, there is a Facebook page for Coalition for Secure and Transparent Elections.
And Transparent actually comes first in that.
Okay.
So Coalition for Transparent, I think. let me double check. Yes, it's called Missouri's Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections.
Okay.
And we would love for everybody to go there and like our page. And we will, post things. What is the status on the lawsuit donations, Philip? Do you know, or could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the first pass at it, we've gotten about, I would say $300. but there's been a significant effort, I know, in the last week or so, and it's coming to me. The donations come to my address, but I've been out of town, so I do not know what the what's occurred in the last week. There could be a significant amount. I don't know. We have about, I guess we were about a tenth of the way we would need to be in order to have enough money to do the total lawsuit.
What is actionable that you're suing about?
Well, you have to understand that we have been at this for about 8 years. We didn't start with the legislature. We started with the Board of Elections, and we worked several years trying to get changes there. And then we went to the legislature, and we've been going to the legislature for 6 years. And every year we've taken a bill, essentially the same bill all 6 years, to the legislature. And so we've talked to a lot of people there. We don't, you know, there's not much feedback that's negative in the legislature. We don't have, I mean, there's zero practically for all effects and purposes. So what happens is that we've learned that all power exists in the leadership. So,
right.
You know, a bill, it doesn't go to the leadership just once and then on to the process of committees and that sort of thing. It happens that it goes to the leadership to begin with, and it gets assigned to committee, and then it comes out of committee and it goes back to the leadership. So the leadership gets it about 18 times. And as a result, it's easy for a bill to die because the leadership wants it to die. And it can appear to be because the chairman of a committee decided they didn't like it or, you know. But basically it comes down to all power exists in the leadership. And having been through this for now 6 years, it's apparent that the legislature, unless we have, well, There appears to be only one person that I know for certain is opposed to our legislation, and if that one person is in control of the legislature, there's no reason to expect that we'll get a much different output if we don't use some other strategy, and that's the reason for going to the courts, because the courts can look at this and decide whether, you know, Missouri's Constitution or this Bill of Rights requires that we have an open and free election. And there's nothing open about the current process. It's absolutely nothing open because, to start with, the computer software is not open. It's illegal in Missouri to look at the software that's used in the computer. That is to say, the software that comes with this system that they bought from a manufacturer. That's proprietary software, and the only time that you can look at that software in Missouri is if the company that provided it to you goes bankrupt. If it's fraud suspected, you specifically cannot look at the software to find out if there's fraud, and that's built into the software.
Wow. Wow. So that's incredible.
The court is the only place left that I can see that there's a reasonable opportunity for us to get to take a step back toward an open election process that's guaranteed by the Bill of Rights for Missourians.
Wow, that speaks volumes right there, doesn't it? How much money do you need to file this lawsuit?
Well, the amount of money we need to file it is a lot less than what we need to complete it. So, you know, we can probably file it with about $3,500.
File it with 50. Yeah.
But we can. It'll probably take closer to 20 to take it all the way to the courts. So, and we're, you know, a tenth of the way there.
You an attorney, Philip?
No.
Okay.
I'm a business processing guy.
Data processor?
Well, I was the guy that connected the data processing with the departments.
Okay. Just curious.
That's all right.
Okay, so basically we're asking the court to demand that St. Louis County get rid of these machines. Is that what we're asking them to do?
Yes, I think that would be one of the proper things to ask for is to say, get rid of them.
Okay.
It's not going to cost you anything more. You don't have to buy any more machines, so just don't use them because they're not open, period.
So let's fall back to this financial review in the House. Frieda, you seemed to want to talk about that. What were they saying was going? How much did they say this was going to cost?
$20 million.
And what were they saying was going to cost $20 million?
Well, we were never really sure, but the assumption was that new machines needed to be purchased if we were going to the paper ballot.
So that when the financial review comes out and they say something's going to cost $20 million, they don't have to itemize that?
I don't know. I'm not sure
provided
what they're looking at, but maybe Phil knows this?
Well, I know that they provide an analysis. It's not very complete. But no, they don't provide a great deal of detail of exactly how they came up with it, except to say that the total is $23 million, I think. But
any time a bill has an item attached to it of more than $350,000, it has to go through fiscal review before it can go to the floor.
Right. Yeah, wow, that's...
I'm not exactly
I make sure
sure
I understand
what the specifics are of the $20 million or the $23 million.
Okay, I wanted to make sure I understand this. They're saying $20 million to...
Yeah, we were not steady enough to understand that was going to stop the bill. We realized that pretty late in the process, and I don't know if we could have insisted on at any point throughout the process that would be removed.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I understood what the $20 million was for. Is this to convert the rest of the state to the scanning machines that read paper ballots?
The rest of the state already has scanning machines.
Okay.
It was not
I bring that up because there are those of us who don't trust the scanning machines very much either.
Yeah, we understand that. But if you use a scanning machine, you have something that is scanned, which is the paper ballot, which is your ultimate backup. You will always have the paper ballot as your backup. Even if the machine, if the scanning machine doesn't work right, you can go back and count the paper.
Yeah, but they generally only do a recount if it's such a close vote, like, say, Amendment 1, right? At what other times would you be able
actually,
to get a recount?
Someone wants a recount.
They do an audit at after every election. Are you aware of that? They do a hand count. It's a small audit. It's a small percentage that is done. It needs to be, I forget, something around 5% or one precinct. So every county is required to do that small audit. And as Philip said, it's supposed to be randomly chosen. The precinct or the areas that they do are supposed to be, the races that they do are supposed to be randomly chosen. And I've watched, you can watch in your county. They are supposed to publish when they do that, or if they don't, you can ask them when they do that. And it usually takes place a few days after the election. And you can watch them do that hand count.
I noticed that the recount of Amendment 1 will not be open to the public, in my county
at least.
St.
Louis County, that is a little different than the regular audit, so that's interesting. St. Louis County,
I was curious as to what the reason for it not being open to the public is. Do you have any idea?
You can be an observer appointed by the party to observe the recount, which I was yesterday. I was observing the recount.
Okay. In the article I read,
in the open. I mean, all these people, there was like 40 people in the room counting paper, I mean, reviewing paper tapes. And I was sitting in the room watching them.
Okay. What, don't some other countries, I think someone mentioned Germany the other day, just using strictly paper ballots with hand count, and that it's a longer process. You don't get results the next morning. But,
you know,
it
doesn't need to take that long, actually. I mean, I saw my county, the ladies in my county, two of them, read and rechecked about 107 ballots in 1 hour. That was just two individuals.
Okay.
And that was for this last election, so there were not 30 things on it, but there was probably about 13 or 14 things on there.
When you're talking about a recount, you're only talking about usually one specific question or candidate or race.
This was everything. This was everything. They went through. This was not a recount. This was not the recount that I was watching. This was the audit. So they had to double check every vote for every race. And like I said, for those 14 or 15 things on 107 ballots, it took them an hour. And so if you had, and our legislation was not going for this, I want to make that very clear, but in my mind, the ideal situation is when those ballots never leave the polling place. They never have to be transported. They are counted right in the location, and it's posted on the door and on the Internet. Am I still on?
You're still on. Yeah, I'm listening. Yeah,
So, I mean, that would be ideal, but we're not there yet.
Right. Now,
we're talking about Germany, and they decided it was a human right that everybody should understand, be able to understand the system by which their votes were counted. And obviously, if they're counted electronically, you really can't understand that. So that's why they went to the paper and the...
Well,
and the hand count.
Yeah, I want to stay away from human rights, or I'll have Tom March on here saying that God gave him a right from Mount Sinai to have his vote counted by three people or something. No. So basically, what we're asking for is in the legislation, if I can just recap here, is a rejection of the electronic counting machines and going back at a minimum to paper ballots and scanners. Point one, right?
Correct. Right.
Point two, we want to keep the ballots in the precinct instead of transporting them somewhere?
That's no part of the legislation.
Oh, okay.
The legislation...
That's just a law of preference. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
The legislation only gets rid of the DREs, and at the same time, it allows for them to be used only for the handicapped until they wear out, in which time they have to be replaced by ballot marking devices for the handicapped. Are you aware of what ballot marking devices are?
Vaguely, but go over it, because maybe all 20,000 of us aren't.
They are similar looking to a touchscreen machine. The handicapped person can use the touchscreen to vote on, but they print out a paper ballot of their choices, and then that is fed into the scanner like a regular ballot is. There are some differences between the manufacturers, but that's the basic idea, that it has to have a paper ballot that is then fed into a machine for counting.
Okay. So what else is encapsulated in this legislation besides that, besides replacing the DREs with or phase, getting rid of them and going back to the scanners?
That's it. One step.
Oh, that's it. One line of code.
We wanted to keep it simple because it's hard to sell change, and this is as simple as it gets. We wanted to take one baby step back toward transparency.
And so, to be perfectly honest with everyone now, there is virtually no cost to doing this, unless you want to say a cost of doing this is the money that we wasted on these damn DREs.
Well, there is a cost, undoubtedly, because they'll have to change their procedures, and they'll have to retrain people to deal with, and they'll have to print more paper ballots. But the printing cost of the paper ballots is infinitesimally small compared to the cost of warehousing in air-conditioned and heated warehouses these machines under secure conditions, to the cost of transporting 1,800 machines to 400 different locations for St. Louis County. There are lots of costs that they would eventually get rid of.
So to be perfectly honest with everyone, we're probably actually talking a long-term cost savings.
There's absolute certainty that there's a long-term cost savings, period.
Okay.
For example, in St. Louis County, the cost in the 4 years prior to using these machines compared to the 4 years just after they started using them went up on an average of 30% in total.
Wow.
The change between the time before and the time after, there were no other statistics that changed during that time. So, for example, the number of people that were registered, the number of people who voted, the number of any operational statistic you want to look at stayed the same from one time to the next. So why did the cost go up 30%? I would say that the cost went up 30% because of the operational cost of keeping up with these machines and having the technicians that deal with them and so forth and so on.
And can you...
And we found virtually the same thing in Boone County.
Okay. And that,
okay, to whoever can answer this, why did we get these machines initially? And I'm thinking of the old Jerry Maguire line, follow the money. Who benefited financially from this, and what representative or senator or both sponsored this legislation, and does anyone know if they have ties to, did they gain somehow? Has that been checked out?
I think that the political...
And I'm sorry to sound so cynical about my fellow man, but...
I think the politically correct answer to that is that the states were somewhat stampeded into doing something. And
by the federal government.
Yeah, because there was money available and you had to spend it in a certain period of time. There may be other, lines to follow about who benefited from it, but at the base of it, they were trying to do something in a hurry.
And John Deal was the head of the Board of Elections in St. Louis County at the time they were purchased, and...
Let's repeat that so everyone remembers that name.
Representative John Deal.
So he's got a dog in this fight then.
Yes.
Okay. All right. It's not just my expert versus your expert. He has a bit of his own personal integrity involved in this fight.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Got it. Okay. See.
He's actually gone to Mongolia and he has shared with the parliament and the president some things there about the machines.
Say that again about the Mongolia part. I'm sorry.
From Mongolia, she's barking.
He has taken trips to Mongolia to promote the use of electronic machines and good practices, good election practices.
Do they vote in Mongolia?
Yes.
I wasn't aware of that. John, Representative John, obviously is though.
They vote for one party in Mongolia. They're part of China.
Okay, so tell us. I want to start before we go to the next break. I want to start laying out the things that the listeners need to take away from this. Where do we go to donate money for the lawsuit?
Well, the checks can go to, they need to be made out to the Missourians for Honest Elections Education Fund, and they would be mailed to P.O. Box 16122, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. That is a charitable organization.
Okay.
It is tax-deductible.
Is there a website? Does Missourians for Honest Elections have a website?
We have a website, but the Facebook page that Laura gave you earlier is probably much more up to date. We have the four or five of us are relatively thinly spread, so I think we probably would focus on the Facebook page that Laura was talking about.
You don't have a website?
Yes, we can do that.
You don't
have
a website?
Yes,
can I go
there? Website.
Can I go there and make donations?
No, at this point.
Okay.
Not.
All right. That's fine. That's where I was going. I don't particularly care whether people go to the website or the Facebook page. Either one is fine with me. But
right.
I was just trying to find all of the different ways that a person could go and send you guys $10 or $15. All right. And so we have a Facebook page called the Missouri's Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections that people need to be writing down. Listen up, people. Get your pencils. You've got Missouri's Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections on Facebook. And you've got donations needed to fund a lawsuit to ask the courts to force Missouri to get rid of these machines. That donation needs to be sent to Missourians for Honest Elections Education Fund at P.O. Box 16122, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. Any one of the three of you, are there corollary programs to what you folks are doing here going on in any of the 50 other states?
Yes. Many states have gotten rid of the machines, period. And other states have experienced some of the real problems and have actually been embarrassed by them. There was an election in South Carolina where a person who never campaigned, didn't have any money in it, didn't go outside of his house, got 80% of the vote. And his the thing was, though, that the write-in votes were 80% to the other person, the politician who actually went out and did things. And we, because we've been following this for so long, we've talked to people who've done some research there, and they believe that what happened was there was a programming error. All of the machines in South Carolina are identical to the ones used in St. Louis County. There was a programmer there who made an error. They wrote the program for the whole state. They made an error and placed the votes in the wrong column in the final tabulation. And as a result, the candidate who was a Democratic Senate race, and so you know, in South Carolina there was not much chance of it making a whole lot of difference anyway. So nobody protested. But basically, this was an error made on this kind of machine, and South Carolina, as far as I know, hasn't done anything about it yet. But a number of states have.
Okay. That's good. How much ahead of the power curve are we with this legislation we're trying to file and with this lawsuit? I mean, I really like to try to float a banner when Missouri is in, you know, and we've got a, you know, we like to think of ourselves as the bellwether state. So I really like to raise a banner when we're in the lead on something. How far behind the power curve are we on this?
I think there are 13 states that have either acted or have indicated that they would like to act when they can afford it.
Some okay.
of them didn't. We have, I think there are actually 17 states who, right now who are totally paper ballot. We would be the 18th is what I remember from
okay.
oh.
doing the research.
Well, that's...
I'm very curious about the... the machines used in that district in Ohio in the last presidential election where 110% of the people voted for Obama and no one voted for Mitt Romney. Do you know what kind of machines they use there?
Electronic.
Okay. I mean, are they similar to, say, what St. Louis uses?
Well, Ohio uses three different kinds of machines, and those three machines are all used in Missouri in one place or another. So I don't know
okay.
what machine you're referring to,
I believe those three machines were the ones specifically talked about by one of the studies in your white paper. I think probably the Ohio State study.
Yes, the Everest Report.
Yeah. Right, the Everest Report. Exactly. Listen, folks, we've got to take a quick break, and then we've got some callers on the line with some questions. We'll be right back.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
You go fast and wrong for right and right for wrong. People on the sample that for just so long. I don't have the gift of the prophecy, telling everybody how it's gonna be. There's a wildfire catching in the whip of the wind. Start a complication like this, it's never been.
All right. All right, we're back.
Doubles our 4G LTE bandwidth in cities nationwide. So be that guy with Verizon XLTE.
Now get 1 gig of bonus data and our best pricing ever on the More Everything plan.
Okay, whatever that was. We are back. We've got Laura Hauslodden, Philip Michaels, and Frida Keo from Missourians for Honest Elections and the Missouri Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections. We've been talking tonight about the technical issues of voter fraud, how easy it is to manipulate these DRE machines that are used at other places in the states, but specifically for tonight's talk in St. Louis County. We've gone over a white paper that Philip authored that detailed some very technical and in-depth studies that basically showed how easy it is to manipulate these machines. We've gone over some actual cases of machine manipulation. I don't want to let people who are visiting us in the chat room or at Twitter believe that we are ignoring them, so I'm going to tell the guy who's asked three times now since the show started when we're going to talk about voter ID that is voter fraud. There's no doubt about it. It's significant voter fraud that voter ID talks about. We've had shows dealing with voter ID. As the legislative session approaches, I'll guarantee you we'll have shows talking about that again. This is a different thing we're talking about tonight. It's not actually who's voting, but how votes are being tabulated and counted. We have Keith from up in the northwest part of the state is with us tonight, and he has a question for you folks on the panel. Keith, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to get some feedback here. Hope you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Once again, just can give – I got in late or started late, and so I didn't get really Phil's credentials or just weren't – maybe the report that he's talking about, once again, where it's available, and is this something that's on this report, is it something that can happen, or has it been documented that it definitely has happened?
The report is not posted online, I don't think. Is it, Laura? Do you know?
No. No. We might be able to figure that out.
It's not proprietary or anything, is it, Philip?
No, we don't mind. I mean, they don't have any problem.
Oh, okay. I'll forward that to you, Keith. I've got a copy of it here that Philip sent me, so I'll forward that to you.
The other thing I just wanted to thank you folks, you know, there's nothing more important than the integrity of our vote. Our men and women go across really to all parts, many parts of this world, different continents, and across even in the Middle East, and they fight. They give their lives in some cases so people can have the right to vote in other places, and just it seems how appalling that this is possible. We just once again, Phil, is this something that's just documented as possible, or do we know of some individual? I mean, besides you mentioned South Carolina, but I mean specifically in Missouri, is it just a possibility, or is some documented that it actually has happened?
What we were trying to do with the paper was to document holes that have been found or we've discovered in either the process for handling votes or in the software or hardware that is currently being used. And we were trying to do that in as authoritative a form as possible so that if they went to court with it, they would be able to use it in court. There are a number of examples, I've given one, of where these machines have been used and they have had problems. If I think that there would be people on the other side of this issue would say, well, no one has ever found electronic election fraud in Missouri. And to that I would answer, that's correct, but the system that's been devised for this equipment is basically devised so that you can't ever catch anybody at electronic election fraud. It's unauditable. You can't determine from an audit whether the right votes were collected or the right count was made. In terms of looking for proof that electronic election fraud has happened, no, that hadn't happened. But proof that there are holes in the software has happened.
And basically what you're saying, if I'm not mistaken, is the system was designed as though almost intentionally so, but maybe not, to prohibit you from ever finding out the answer to that.
That's correct.
So my question is, again, okay, I'm going to follow up it. Obviously, that's a good answer. We don't know that it has happened or if it hasn't, because if it's designed so you can't. But have we detected that this software, which has this capability, I mean, has it been found to actually exist? Or is it? I'm just trying to find out whether this is theoretical or no. This has been identified on a machine somewhere, and it's definitely not only theory, but it's definitely happened.
Well, the people in the Everest report in Ohio went through the machine and the software in detail, and they used a red team approach, which means that they were looking for, they had a group of people that were looking for ways into the software and the hardware. They identified a number of very specific hardware and software problems in the code that we know about already. So that has been discovered and documented. These people did that. And you can read the report and get an idea of that. I don't think they give you everything you'd like to see, but they did find that.
Phil, can you talk for a moment about the documented undervote?
Yes. In Florida in 2006, I believe, they had a situation where 18,000 people went to the polls and in a very contentious election and didn't vote for the U.S. House of Representatives race, period. And they were in one party's district. Most of these votes didn't occur in one party's district. And there were a lot of, after this occurred, there were a lot of accusations made in the following 2 weeks that it was in the public eye, and then it died. Subsequently, a public group about 2 years later figured out that there was a relationship, or seemed to be a relationship, between the charges and the batteries and the undervotes. And they said this because the county that you may have heard about where the 18,000 votes, undervotes occurred, was not the only county in the state that had this problem. There were five other counties that had the same kind of percentages, anywhere from 11 to 23% undervote in highly contested races. What that meant was that there was something about in common to those five counties. Well, the things that those five counties in Florida had in common were that they all had the ES&S Ivotronics equipment, and that's the equipment that's used in St. Louis County today. And as far as I know, it's the same equipment. Now, you know, there's not a smoking gun exactly, but, you know, statistically it gets to be really difficult to ignore the fact that this particular equipment that's used in St. Louis County anyway has the potential, I think, to lose votes.
And the reason that this is significant, the St. Louis County machine, because it is the largest, it is the county with the largest voter database, 670,000 people. If you can manipulate the votes in St. Louis County, you are fixing the election for the state.
I see. No question.
Does that help, Keith?
Absolutely. Once again, you guys have been at this. I know you said this before, and you've been at this for quite some time. It seems like you continue to come up against political hurdles, and So what you said to me is there's been situations in which the leadership in the Missouri legislature have showed you support, but up to now, it's pretty evident to you that the Missouri Republican leadership has blocked this bill from coming to one house or the other for a full vote.
I don't
Correct.
Think you can put this on one party, Keith. I wish you could, but you can't.
Well, I mean, we thought that they are, presently they are in leadership, they're in the majority, so that's my only reason for saying that. But if they...
Just don't forget that the Secretary of State put a fiscal note of $23 million on the bill this year. That was, let me say that that particular presentation to the committee got laughed out of the committees. The person that was there to defend the Secretary's position was basically laughed out of the committee because of the fiscal note.
Well, I want to make one other thing. I know you folks have been in a long time, and I just want to – I'm going to put in a note for a meeting that's in Jefferson City on October the 4th, and hope that it's Missouri Alliance for Freedom, and it's on October the 4th. There'll be some folks at the DoubleTree in Jefferson City, and I hope that you'll come, and I'd love to meet you, and I think there'll be people there who will be interested in what you have to say. I don't think there'll be – I don't know that there'll be an opportunity to have a table or a booth, but I hope that you'll come and visit with people there, because there'll be people there that will want to know what you've got to say.
When are you going to be there?
It's October the 4th. It's Saturday. DoubleTree Hotel in Jefferson City. And there's a very, you can see it on a lot of sites. I'll be promoting on several sites. If you want to go to Convention of States Missouri, that'll be promoted on there. I think I'll actually put it on there. I'll clip it on there so it stays at the top. But Brian Johnson and the Missouri Alliance for Freedom sponsoring that. But there's going to be a lot of folks at that event, and I hope we can hook up, and there'll be a lot of folks who'd like to listen to what you have to say. And if we're not no room on the program this time, that sounds like something that needs to be possibly give you some time on the program in the future, and I'll put a good word in for you.
Thank you, Keith.
Thanks,
Let me
Keith.
Just say one other thing. In the last legislature, we had close to 80 votes. It takes 82 votes to get something passed. It was simply stopped by the leadership. The legislative body is in favor of this bill.
Okay, sorry, I was offline there communicating with Laura, who we've lost. She says she's going to try to get back though. But she has dropped off. Laura is no longer with us at the moment, although she is trying to get back. And I think there she is. We're going to move on here and just briefly touch. We've only got like 5 minutes left, so we're going to briefly touch on something that's coming up. First of all, I want to get in a plug for Missouri Grassroots Radio really quickly. Monday nights. Or Tuesday nights, I'm sorry, on Missouri Grassroots Radio, Cynthia Davis comes along with Homefront. That's a great show. Cynthia is an outstanding activist, Constitution Party, liberty-minded woman. She has a great show every Tuesday night. She brings in some powerful guests. It's a little different format than the one I'm getting ready to talk about on Wednesday night. She usually brings in a guest to talk about a topic for the entire 2 hours. But Cynthia herself is knowledgeable. It's a show where you'll get educated and you'll come away from that feeling a little bit better about what you know and how you know it. And Cynthia's a hoot. I mean, she's entertaining to listen to. Wednesday night, Lisa Payne-Nager comes along. with a show that's a little bit differently formatted. Lisa covers five or six different topics, usually on culture vigilante, in bang, 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 bang style. And what you'll come away from Lisa's show, it almost always is pissed off. She gets into the nitty-gritty. She gets down and dirty. She names names. Lisa is a no-holes-barred fighter when it comes to activist conservative principles. Then, of course, on Friday and Saturday, just to round out your week and just to get you closer to perfection, Dave and Mike will be back next week. Next Friday night, I am targeting next Friday night for Deal or No Deal night. We're going to have people here who are going to try to convince you, 20,000 people, and as many people as you can get a hold of and convince, to call your state house member and try to subvert the process. We've talked quite a bit tonight about the leadership. I tell you what, I smell major, and this is folks, this is one of the important things here, this thing we're talking about tonight, this paper ballots initiative. I can tell you right now that John Deal, the proposed Speaker of the House, was quite obstructionist in the article of impeachment against Jay Nixon, the one that I was behind, that tried to impeach Jay Nixon for blatantly refusing to allow special elections to fill five House seats, leaving 250,000 Missourians without any representation in Jefferson City for an entire legislative session. I'll tell you right now that John Deal was obstructionist in the legislation to get Missouri in on the call for a convention of states. And you've heard tonight how he was obstructionist in this. I'll tell you that that in my mind, John Deal will bring you Medicaid expansion.
Oh, yes. So he's for it.
So next week we're going to spend Friday night talking about Deal or No Deal. And
for
I
those who care about food freedom, John Deal obstructed the Farmer to Consumer Direct Trade Food Freedom Bill too.
Okay. So we'll be dealing with that next week. For the whole 2 hours. Get your calls in, get your notes in, get your research in, and we'll be dealing with that.
Friday?
Oh, thank you.
Is hello?
How are you doing?
Mike, did you say?
And okay. All's quiet now. I guess all mics are muted except mine right now. I'm sorry. But I wanted to do a little bit of communicating here. That last promo that you heard, Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're not a 501c3. We don't collect any money. We don't deal with any tax people. We only allow you to donate for one thing, and that is our Secret Santa project. We're way behind the power curve this year on the Secret Santa project. So follow through with that. Any show that you miss, you can go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org or Missouri Grassroots Radio and get a podcast of it. I'm moving through this administrative stuff very quickly because I want to get our guests back, thank them, and get some last words from them all. Laura, are you there?
I am.
Thanks for coming along tonight. I appreciate it. And to get in some last words for people, get in a plug for what you're doing and tell people what they need to do.
Oh, thank you so much for having us on, and appreciate if people would keep abreast of the issue by going to the Missouri Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections Facebook page, and I have put up there the address to send donations to if they would like to send donations to help with the lawsuit.
Good.
And so, yes, thank you so much.
Come back and join us as things progress. I'd really like to touch back on this subject at least once or twice more before the legislative session starts. I'd like to revisit it as frequently as we need to during the legislative session, maybe not for 2 hours each time, but at least for you to come on or Philip or Frieda or all three to spend, you know, a 15 or 20 minute segment with us as the legislation goes on. Let us know who we need to contact, who we need to be pushing, what we need to be doing.
That's great.
Okay. Philip, thank you very much. An outstanding job on that white paper. I spent some time on it today. It wasn't that long. It's 11 pages, and it was very well researched or a good compilation of well-researched stuff, let me put it that way. There's some powerful stuff there. I hope maybe Laura or Frieda can maybe use the documents thing on their website or something to give more people broader access to that paper. It's an outstanding paper. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your in-depth knowledge and your passion on this.
Thank you for giving us this opportunity, and we appreciate it.
Oh,
I will post the white paper on the website of the Missouri Precinct Project. I don't know why it hasn't occurred to me yet, but I will put it on there and send out an email to alert people to that. And maybe Laura can refer to it on her Facebook page.
Thank you, Frieda. That last speaker was Frieda Keough. We want to thank her once more for coming along, and also thanks for MOPP work, Frieda. But specifically, we're on this subject tonight. We want to thank you for your presentation. We want to thank you for everything that all of you do for us in Jefferson City on this issue and for keeping us posted on what's going on. Thanks for being here tonight, Frieda.
Thank you.
All right, Mike. That was really probably a lot of information in a short period of time, but one of the most informative shows that we've done in a long, long time.
I was taking notes. This was an outstanding show. Three really, really knowledgeable people.
Yes. And I'm looking forward to taking part in this battle or adding this battle to my major strategic warfighting plans for the next and upcoming. You know, I went time after time after time to MOP or to some link that Laura had left on Missouri Grassroots Coalition and read about this stuff. I think I even filled out a witness form or two during the legislative session, but it wasn't something that I spent a lot of time researching or finding out about. I mean, you know, it, someone said paper ballots and the voting machines were bad, and I trusted them, so I filled out some witness forms. But I feel a lot more breadth of my knowledge and concern about this now, especially after reading that great white paper that Philip did, and I'm looking forward to taking on this fight myself, just kind of as a backbencher to these people who know so much more about it.
And I think it's a little more ammunition for the deal or no deal campaign.
Oh yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Let me get Keith is still on me.
You bet. Still here. You've got a canine
hey,
there, Dave.
Not me. That's Mike's pet. But thanks for coming on. Those were good questions, Keith. And we'll get back with this Convention of the States things here at least once or twice more before the legislative session starts. And like I told the ladies and Phil, as the session goes on, we'll be sure and get you back here so that we can keep track of who we need to be pushing and who we need to be coercing.
Sure. Well, hope that everybody will go ahead and put on their email list and send out to all the preservative email lists. that October 4th date, Life, Liberty, and Property in Jefferson City. Got a good lineup of speakers, and there was an earlier message said it was going to be at the Capitol Plaza. That's been changed to the DoubleTree once again on October the 4th. And you can go to Missouri Alliance for Freedom, or you can go to Missouri Alliance for Freedom's Facebook page and click on that link for that event and let them know you're coming.
Thanks, Keith. Good night. Okay, Mike, we got 10 seconds left, so let's say that as always, I've had a good time here with you tonight, and I'll be back with you next Friday, same time, same place.
Looking forward to it. Have a
good
week.
Night, Mike. You too, sir.
There are so many contradictions in all these messages we send. Keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit in? Though the